Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The internet is letting more and more people share the things they have and make money doing it. You can now rent your spare room, your car, your sewing machine, or ladder on sites like Airbnb, Flight Car, Snap Goods. It's a surging new frontier, one that tax collectors, regulators, and old-time companies are very warily trying to figure out, and one that experts say could lead us to ultimately owning less stuff. This hour on Point, we venture into the new sharing economy. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Is that you buying just a little of someone else's stuff? It's time. Is that you renting your weed whacker, your sewing machine? Have you tried Airbnb, Flight Car, Snap Goods, Uber? What was your experience? Is this the future? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we'll look at the new bike sharing programs in New York, Chicago, Boston, Columbus, and beyond. But first, to the whole world of the sharing economy. Here's a little video released by Relay Rides. You've got your car, you're not using it, maybe somebody else would like to, rent it.
Relay Rides makes it easy for me to rent my car to people when I don't need it. I just list it on the Relay Rides marketplace, set availability, pick a price, then sit back and watch the extra cash roll in.
For that automobile of yours, got an extra room you're not using? Maybe somebody visiting from Madrid would like to use it. Here's a little video from Airbnb. Hosts share with why they participate beyond the cash in Airbnb.
One amazing thing is that I get to help people live their dreams. And that is why I host.
It's all beautiful soundtracks in the world of the sharing economy. We're going to look at it. Joining me now from New York is Arun Sundarajan, professor of information, operations, and management sciences at New York University's Stern School of Business. He's been closely following the rapid evolution of the new sharing or collaborative economy. Arun, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks, Tom. It's good to be here.
And with us from San Francisco is Lauren Anderson, Chief Knowledge Officer at Collaborative Lab, a consulting firm that helps city governments and companies prepare for the collaborative economy. Lauren, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Really appreciate being here.
So you could look at this as a kind of fringy thing, but I'm not sure that's true anymore, Arun. I'm reading here, you know, by one estimate, 40,000 people probably last night rented accommodation somewhere in the world from Airbnb in 30,000 cities, 192 countries, 250,000 rooms on demand. They call it the sharing economy. But there's a lot of money moving through this at this point, Arun.
Yes. I mean, it may have started out as something that was on the fringes, but the sharing economy is definitely going mainstream. It's providing a sort of a viable alternative to the traditional model of, you know, go to a company and rent their space or rent their car or, like, you know, go to Best Buy and buy an asset. I mean, these new digital marketplaces are creating platforms that, you know, actually what's really interesting about is that they enable individuals to use physical resources more efficiently. And, like, you know, they're leading us towards a more asset-light model of consumption where instead of actually having to own the asset in order to consume it, you can just simply utilize a fraction of it, a share of someone else's. And this is certainly changing the way people find accommodation. It's changing the way people find transportation. It's beginning to change the way that you know, individuals think about, you know, how should I plan my consumption? So it's certainly something that we should look out for as being sort of a very mainstream trend in the years to come.
We're going to look how widely it may go. What kinds of goods, services for that matter? Lauren Anderson, this began in a sort of marginal way. Where is it now? Arun says mainstream. Does this stay marginal? Does it really contend with our old-fashioned you buy it, you own it, you use it model? Are we in that kind of flight path here for things to really change that much?
I think what's interesting about the sharing economy, or collaborative consumption as we call it, is that it has become this global trend in a very short space of time. And we've actually seen the same kinds of examples of, you know, peer-to-peer accommodation, peer-to-peer car sharing, bike sharing, spreading all around the world simultaneously, because it really heralds a bigger change in the way we think about what and how we consume. So we're actually seeing a behavioural or a consumer shift that's driving forward these technology platforms that are enabling people to connect with each other. I think that's the part that makes it so important, and the thing that's going to keep it growing over the next couple of years.
Give us a sense of the range of things that I can now buy a little bit of their time through these collaborative outfits, sharing economy outfits. What can I know I can go and get a piece of a car, an automobile's time. I know I can rent somebody's room instead of paying for that hotel in Amsterdam. What else?
What I think is amazing is you can pretty much apply this model to any aspect of your life. And we sort of look at these new companies that are coming out, and they're really targeting our stuff, our physical possessions, whether that's, you know, household possessions or even more expensive equipment such as tools. Think of all the makers who want access to 3D printers and laser cutters. There's that kind of stuff component to it. There's also this space part of it, which is beyond just what Airbnb and the peer-to-peer accommodation marketplaces are providing. We're looking at co-working spaces. We're looking at storage space. We're looking at actually specialized venues, whether it's commercial kitchens or event spaces, that are actually being maximized to their full potential. And then on the other side, we have the less tangible assets, which are things like our skills, the things that we know and that we can teach other people and actually pass those on in a way that actually returns money to us at the same time. So we have more than 1,000 examples of collaborative consumption documented in our directory. And I think this trend just continues to grow. I get new examples on my desk every day.
Everything I'm reading here, from children's toys, your kids yep. outgrow the toys, up they go on the internet marketplace, off they go. Heavy equipment, I've got it, I'm using it, but not all the time. Boom, do you want a piece of it, an hour of it? On and on and on. And as you say, services as well. Share my nanny, you know, that's out there as well now.
Dog vacay, perhaps you want to borrow someone's pet for the weekend.
Okay. Never mind my car, my house, my third bedroom, second bedroom, first bedroom if I'm out of town.
You know, if you actually go on Snapgoods and look at what they have offered for you, I mean, the range is stunning. You've got a Nikon camera, you've got a Sony PSP, you've got a two-person tent, you've got an aluminum stepladder, a baby Einstein musical motion jumper.
Is it worth it? Is it easy enough to get all these goods into the hands where they're needed at the moment when they're needed with the internet, Arun, to make this really workable?
Well, I think that's actually a really good question, Tom, because I think it's going to work really well for some kinds of products and not so well for other kinds of products. And you've already sort of highlighted some of the features of products that I think will make them most suitable for, you know, collaborative consumption or the sharing economy. These are these things that are, valuable, that we're not using every day. And, you know, so, you know, if we go beyond, right now we're sort of at this point where we're taking, the hotel, the concept of a hotel where, you know, it's well established that, you know, when you go to another city, you're going to need to find short-term accommodation for a few days. You're going to need to sort of borrow, you know, a car from Hertz or from Avis and pay them money for it.
Mm-hmm.
So these are well-established behaviors that we have, you know, finding short-term accommodation, finding a short-term car rental. And these are the ones that we're seeing initially move to a sharing economy, peer economy, collaborative consumption model.
Mm-hmm.
I think things are going to get really interesting when people start to realize that it's not just old behaviors that they have to replicate using the new collaborative consumption platforms. This sort of expands your choice dramatically. I mean, maybe you don't want to invest $500 into buying a Roomba robotic vacuum cleaner.
Right.
Even though it's sort of like, you know, it's sort of an appealing thing.
Yeah.
But you'd be pretty happy to sort of plunk down $10 every now and again to have it run around your apartment.
It's just amazing. and pretty soon we're all light on goods, heavy on access to goods, but not goods that we own. This must be driving old line companies crazy, not to mention, as we said, tax collectors. We'll look at that. We've got a lot of callers already here, if I may. Monica in South Windsor, Connecticut. Monica, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. My family is a frequent user of Airbnb. We mainly started using it because we have a large family. We have 5 young children.
Okay.
And to travel anywhere with that kind of size is impossible. It's pretty much impossible to find economical accommodations. But
so where have you gone with Airbnb?
We've been to London, Scotland, Paris.
And so you go online, Airbnb, London, let's say, and what? Up come people with apartments big enough or houses, whatever it is, for your family and the price for per night.
Exactly. I check, you know, entire home, 3 bedrooms, and we've been able to stay, for instance, we stayed a week in Paris for $250 a night.
Wow.
For a beautiful apartment.
A night. For a big apartment. Okay.
For a large apartment, you know, which was much, much cheaper than getting 2 to 3 hotel rooms, you know.
Is it creepy moving into somebody else's place for a week, or is it cool?
You know, it's been really cool because not only do we get the size of the housing we need, it's been really, we've been really lucky and had wonderful owners of these homes that have been locals, that have told us, you know, where to go, what restaurants to eat at, who have been, you know, helping us get around the city. Or we did a month-long stay in London for my husband was going there for work, and the only way we could afford to go with him was if we rented a house from Airbnb, and it was just a wonderful thing. It was, you know, we took over their home, and they were gracious and accommodating. And
when it's over, you rate them, and they rate you as guests. How are you doing on that front, Monica?
We're doing great, you know, and it's been, especially in Europe, you know, large families are not the common thing. And so the most frequent comment we get is their children are very well behaved, which, you know, as a mother makes me very proud. And as she, you know, when we go on and other owners can see that, they know we're not going to come and tear apart their house.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about the new sharing economy or collaborative economy. You rent my house, I rent your car, from Airbnb to Uber to Snapgoods. Why should we all own everything? You rent mine, I'll rent yours. That's kind of the new ethos here, and off we go. Make a little money, spend a little less. Maybe the new way. It's shaking up the old way, that's for sure. Arun Sundararajan is with us this hour from New York. He's at New York University's Stern School of Business. Lauren Anderson is with us from San Francisco, Chief Knowledge Officer at Collaborative Lab. They help city governments and companies prepare for a sharing economy. It's sharing in a new sense, not the old freestyle. And we've got some listeners online bemoaning that. But hey, you want something I've got? You can rent it for an hour or a day, and off we go. Car, house, power drill, right on down. Arun was saying Snapgoods, it's online. You can rent almost anything from somebody else for a little while. Here's a video from the company.
So I was tracking a friend's album, and my inbox broke, and he was only going to be in town for another weekend. So I was able to turn to Snapgoods and connect with another friend in the neighborhood who happened to have an inbox as well, that I was able to rent from him for a couple days and finish the album while I could. And it was great because it was an actual friend, and I was able to meet him a few blocks down the street at a bar for a beer. And he trusted me with his recording equipment, and it all worked out fantastic.
Who knew? Recording equipment, an inbox, boom, he's got it, off he goes. Or you're going out of town, you're leaving your car at the airport, you could let it sit in the parking lot and you pay. Or somebody else could use it while you're away and you make money. Flight Car organizes that. We'll talk in a few minutes with the CEO of Flight Car, but here's their pitch.
If someone wants to rent your car, we'll check their driving history. On your way to the airport, give us a call, and we'll let you know where to meet us, right at the airport. A Flight Car team member will greet you, help you with your bags, and pick up your keys. If you're a renter, we'll bring your rental car right to you at the airport, and you're ready to go. No more shuttles. It's that easy.
It's that easy. Now, if you're a car rental company, you're scratching your head, or a hotelier, or maybe the town that used to make tax revenue off of those. We've got a new trend here. Let's get our callers right in. Kenji in Somerville, Massachusetts. What do you think, Kenji? You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I guess I sort of see the whole sharing economy as beginning with Napster and the idea that the internet sort of allows people to facilitates the sharing of information, and that this sort of with the sort of famed takedown of Napster and then the $1 million lawsuits that were prosecuted against some people who were sharing files on Napster. And I see them sort of as a society conflicted about how we feel about the, you know, people's ability to share information or things and to make, you know, in this case, money off of it. And in New York City, for example, I know that they have sort of waged a little bit of a war against Airbnb, and I think at some are trying to shut down Airbnb inside New York City, mostly because of their inability to tax the income that people are making off them.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, they're trying to stop Airbnb, but on the other hand, they're sort of launching this bike sharing program throughout the whole city in the five boroughs in order to help people share these bikes. And that's just sort of another example of our conflict over how we want to deal with this new economy that is emerging.
Kenji, you've got your eye right on the trend line and some of the conflicts that come along with it, as well as some of the benefits. I mean, Lauren, big cities with well-established, long-time patterns of commercial rental of rooms and cars and cabs and all the rest have, in some cases, been the most resistant here. What about New York? Didn't they bring suit against somebody who rented out his apartment in the city?
Yeah, Kenji's absolutely right. It really is an interesting situation. And what we're seeing is this kind of a reaction against the incumbents and the existing stakeholders to these new and innovative forms of business. The situation in Airbnb is far more complicated than even the news and the media reports can explain, because the laws themselves are so complicated that even when you try to rationalize one law against the other, they actually don't make sense. And so these companies are really operating in a legal gray area, and that's where we're finding a lot of reaction, because a particular aspect of that existing housing law might be in conflict, whereas another aspect is completely fine. So we're really seeing companies having to step up and do a lot more negotiating and proactive development of relationships with these governments.
I think I saw a couple of $1,000 fine on Nigel Warren or someone in New York City, and you can imagine in a building in New York, well, okay, all of a sudden he's doing Airbnb, but there's somebody who's got a key to be in the lobby or be in the hallways that, I mean, it's great if you're visiting from Paris and it's a nice apartment in New York, but what about the neighbors?
Right. And I think that that's a big part of what needs to happen next, is the relationships that we build with our neighbors are extremely crucial in this situation, because you can understand how somebody might feel if there was, you know, strangers walking in and out of your building all the time and you don't have the opportunity to vet those people. But the act of opening up your home to somebody else in itself shouldn't be made illegal for those reasons alone. I think we need to look at the bigger ecosystem of what we're stopping or what we're enabling at the same time. And a city like New York.
Yes, Arun?
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, if you think about it, cities are the foundation of all cities is some form of sharing.
Hmm.
Take New York City where I live. We are a sharing economy already, and we have been for decades. You know, we share space, we share transportation, we share all kinds of other assets, like, you know, garbage cans.
Right. But here are new players bringing that sharing, quote-unquote sharing, it's not free, to a new kind of frontier.
Yeah, so it's just a process of adjustment while we sort of get used to the idea that perhaps this is a behavior that we want to, you know, we can decide whether we want to tolerate it or not. And, the caller, Kenji put in, he hit the nail on the head when he said this sort of started with Napster, because mm-hmm. It did. We got comfortable with the idea of, you know, a new behavior of, like, you know, actually exchanging our music with someone who we didn't know personally, but sort of who had some kind of online identity. And I think in the decade that has followed, we've gotten a lot more comfortable paying for stuff online, and there's a whole host of trust and social capital that's gone online with our use of Facebook and the creation of these reputation systems. The reason why I bring those up is that, you know, this is all tied up in the question of, should New York City or should New York State be sort of imposing these fines or cracking down on Airbnb? And, you know, fundamentally what the government is trying to do is to put in place an infrastructure that keeps people safe when they, say, choose to rent someone else's apartment. At least that's sort of like, you know, the long-term goal.
Yeah.
And when you start to have these online forms of trust that might be good enough for some of the things that the government used to do, then it's really time to sort of take a close look at what the purpose of the laws, what the purpose of the regulations was initially, And when you have these online platforms that perhaps are doing part of the job that the government initially set out to do, whether these laws and these regulations are really necessary.
It's a thicket in a hurry, reputation or trust taking the place, maybe, of regulation, and the economy changing, too. I mean, what it means. We saw eBay's evolution from a place where, you know, individuals went on occasionally and did this to suddenly those were professional eBay traders. I want to go to Lisa, calling from New Orleans in Louisiana. Lisa, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
I have a complaint about my next-door neighbor that specifically bought the house to rent it out units for Airbnb. In New Orleans, for short-term rentals, we have very specific rules about bed and breakfasts, and you can get licensed, and there's a very nice fabric of that so that it doesn't actually eat away at the neighborhood. In my situation, I don't get to have neighbors.
Because what these homes, one-time homes, have all turned into Airbnb, casual rental all the time.
Yes, unlicensed. They're not paying taxes except for the property taxes, but the property taxes are not as a commercial venue. And this has happened all over the French Quarter, in my neighborhood, and in the surrounding neighborhoods to the core of the city. This is a much different situation than in New York, which is so much larger.
So you don't have neighbors next door. You have a stream of vacationers.
You know, who stand in my driveway, make noise at night. I mean, the cops will respond if they're really going above and beyond as far as the noise is concerned. And in many cases, they're very nice people. They just don't understand that they're renting something that is illegal and it's eating at the fabric of my neighborhood.
Are you exaggerating the amount of rental that goes on there, or is it really that's all they do is rent it out?
That's all they do is rent it out. She lives somewhere else.
Wow, that's amazing. Lisa, thank you for your call. Arun, what do you say? There's the professionalization of Airbnb. Actually, if Lisa's right, buying properties to make them full-time rental, but it's not a hotel. The city doesn't get that income. Who knows if they're even claiming it? I mean, our listener online says, you know, where does this go? To an IRS nightmare.
Yeah, I think that this is a great example because it sort of highlights the range of sort of activities that Airbnb is facilitating. You know, on the one, like, you know, a vast majority of people on Airbnb are, you know, what Airbnb originally intended, which is, like, you know, people who are renting out their places occasionally when they travel to sort of supplement their income or to, you know, provide more capacity for a city that doesn't have enough hotels. But on the other extreme, you've got the example of someone who has rented out a place full-time. I think the right solution here is that, you know, what city governments need to do is put in place what I think of as a safe harbor, you know, sort of a simple set of rules that they believe, a simple set of guidelines and a simple set of boundaries for the behaviors that the kinds of commercial activities that they feel are acceptable on these new platforms while we transition from the old regulations to the new. Because maybe the old sort of like, you know, hotel or bed and breakfast laws don't apply perfectly to this new situation.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, the fact that this is residential and not commercial needs to be taken into account.
And Lisa feels like she doesn't have neighbors anymore. It does bring a strong current of commerce right into the everyday fabric of our lives. Arun, Lauren, stand by. Rajul Zaparde joins us now from San Francisco. He is CEO of Flight Car, which allows you to drop off your car at the airport while you're traveling. Flight Car will rent it out and make money for you. The service now up and running in Boston, San Francisco, already facing a lawsuit in the city of San Francisco. Rajul Zaparde, the CEO, is 18 years old. Rajul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John, for having me.
You're 18 years old and getting a lot of people's attention, sort of mixing it up here. How does it work? I go to the airport, you take my keys and arrange for somebody to drive off with it? What do I make if I'm gone for 2 days?
So the way it works, actually, is that the video you played is actually a little bit older than the current model.
Okay.
So you pull into our parking lot. We have our own parking lot a couple minutes away from the airport.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have somebody meet you there, help you with your bags. We'll do a couple minutes of paperwork. And we'll have a limo, like a black town car, drop you off curbside at the airport or anywhere within a 10-minute radius.
And what happens with my car while I'm gone?
We rent it out to another traveler, hopefully, who's coming in.
How do your rates compare to rental company rates?
So compared to rental companies in the area, we're between 30% and 50% cheaper.
So what am I likely to make? I don't know. I'm driving a Chevy Malibu, and I drop it off with you. I go away for 2 days. What am I going to make?
So it depends on the model year, but if it's older, you make $10 per rental, and if it's a newer car, you make $10 per rental day.
$10. Is it worth it for the wear and tear and uncertainty of who's going to be driving it?
Well, you know, we do a 3-year driving history check on everybody renting, and they have to meet our insurance criteria. Of course, everything is fully insured. And not to mention, you are saving, if you're flying out, you are saving the $18 a day that it costs to park your car in long term. Plus, we're more convenient because you don't have to take a shuttle that stops at like 10 different places. We drop you off in a town car, and we also have wash and vacuum out your car.
Okay. San Francisco's brought suit against you guys already. For what, Rajul?
I think at the core of the dispute is, you know, how do you define a company like FlightCar? And the airport sort of wants to just classify us as a traditional car rental agency and just put us in that bucket. But we're really not. We're a peer-to-peer car sharing company, and something that we do that, you know, hurts or advantage Rent-A-Car don't do is we benefit the local community. Just, you know, because of FlightCar, we're making travel more affordable for people, and people, you know, will be able to travel more often because they don't have to pay for parking, because parking costs can add up. And in many cases, if their cars get rented, they can even offset some of their travel costs. So, you know, there is a difference there. The airport wants us to run a shuttle to the airport, basically, and pay them 10% of revenue plus $20 flat per rental. What we do right now is we contract with a couple limo companies to pick up and drop off at the airport or anywhere within a 10-minute radius. And every time our limo company goes to the airport charges them $3.65, and we pay that. So
how does that compare to what the local, I don't know, state or local government makes off? When I do a rental car, there's a pretty hefty, usually, local tax on that. Yours sounds quite a lot less. You're paying sort of tolls.
So if you think about it, we're actually paying four times the $3.65 because for every rental, the renter has to get picked up and dropped off at the airport, and so does the owner.
Yeah.
We're paying about $15 to the airport, and on an average rental of between $90 and $100, that's between 15% and 17% of revenue.
How many miles can I put on that car if I rent it from somebody who's just flown off to Chattanooga?
It's 90 miles a day, and it's 35 cents a mile over. And all of that 35 cents goes to the owner.
What are you going to do to Hertz, Avis, over time?
You know, I mean, the way we think about it is, you know, right now there's a good portion of people that would do something like this, but the vast majority of people wouldn't. About 80% of people would not give their cars to somebody else right now. And that's just based on the research we did when we were starting this company. But we realized, you know, 20% is still a large portion of people. You know, obviously we're very small, so I don't think Hertz or Avis are worried or anything like that yet. But, you know, that's definitely the market share we're going for.
You know, Rajul, you may just be 18 years old, but I have a pretty good idea that Hertz and Avis are paying very close attention to you right now. Do you see, is there a long car at the end of your driveway you worry about?
I'm looking at that right now.
Okay, Rajul Zapardi, good luck. I haven't tried it. How many people have done it so far?
So far, we've booked over 1,500 rentals, and we have over 1,400 vehicles that have been listed on the site since February.
Watch out, ladies and gentlemen. The rental car world may be changing. Rajul Zapardi is CEO of FlightCar, 18 years old, out of San Francisco. Rajul, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, John. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Lauren Anderson, is this the beginning of the end for the rental car business?
Well, I think what we're looking at here is the idling capacity of the assets that we have and how they can actually be put into use. So while this looks like it's you know, cutting into the turf of Hertz and Avis, we're actually seeing a very different situation where we're trying to reduce the amount of infrastructure that's needed at things like airports, where, you know, the vast parking stations are built for idle cars, and we're trying to see people use those cars in a different way to actually have better benefit. And to Rajul's point, people who might be renting cars through FlightCar perhaps wouldn't even be able to afford a typical rental car. So it's a very different market in that sense.
Modest beginnings, but we know how these things can go. Lauren Anderson, Arun Sundararajan, please stand by. We're talking about the new sharing economy. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about the new sharing economy, quote-unquote, the collaborative economy, they call it. You rent my house, iRentYourCar, from Airbnb to Uber to Snap Goods. Why should we all own everything? You rent mine, I'll rent yours. Arun Sundararajan is with us from the Stern School of Business at NYU. Lauren Anderson is with us today from San Francisco. She's Chief Knowledge Officer at Collaborative Lab, a consulting firm that helps city governments and companies prepare for a sharing economy. Here's how The Economist describes, the magazine describes it. They say the model works for items that are expensive to buy and are widely owned by people who do not make full use of them. Bedrooms and cars are the most obvious examples, but you can also rent camping spaces in Sweden, fields in Australia, washing machines in France. As proponents of the sharing economy like to put it, The Economist writes, access now trumps ownership. Well, a lot of it is happening. Tim in Ames, Iowa is calling. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom, Arun, and Lauren. My question is about the insurance implications of this endeavor. Will your insurance policy cover any liability that may be incurred?
Lauren, what about it?
So a lot of the companies have actually taken responsibility for the insurance side of things themselves, especially in the space of peer-to-peer car sharing, so the likes of Relay Rides and Get Around and even Flight Car. So what we're seeing is that the companies realize they need to develop a specific product for this new type of company, because the insurance companies themselves aren't offering a sort of standard response to this new type of business. And I think in taking responsibility for that fact and for developing these products, we actually are seeing the heads turning of a lot of insurance companies. And in fact, we get contacted by a lot of insurance companies trying to understand how they can best actually capitalize on this area, in fact, in the future.
But you've had lawsuits already. There's a car wreck, there's injuries, and you know, the owner's insurance company and the share economy insurance company fighting over who's going to pay.
Yeah, so I think in the case of a company like Relay Rides, they are actually offering the first point of call in the case of an accident, and their coverage is up to $1 million. So they're really stepping in and taking most of the responsibility there. And I think in the history of Relay Rides, there's perhaps been one major incident that's actually caused a bit of grit between the insurance company of the driver and Relay Rides. But it's new territory that we're forging here, and I think the company themselves are trying to be as responsible as they can for the welfare of their community. And it will take time for insurance companies to realize where that liability lies.
Arun, here's John asking on air, says, what is the liability if you rent your power tools, your lawnmower, and somebody whacks their thumb or takes it off? What happens, Arun?
Well, I think that sort of depends on the marketplace that you use and the details for non-standard things like power tools or, you know, baby toys are still being worked out. I do have to say, though, for, just to add to a couple points to what Lauren said, that, you know, what the companies like Relay Rides and Get Around are offering is likely to be a lot better than the insurance coverage you have if you are driving your own car or if you rent it from Avis or Hertz. Mm-hmm. And, you know, these kinds of conflicts between, like, you know, who's liable, they're not new. You know, this is something that...
True.
That's something that comes up when you're driving a rental car as well. But, you know, the there is a good point about, there's a whole host of new liability issues that are bound to come up. I mean, you know, the United States, we like to, there is a tendency to say, well, who is liable when something goes wrong?
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, I mean, there's bound to be a whole bunch of new cases that come up.
New frontier here. If I may, I want to get a couple more calls. We've just got a few minutes here. Brad in Auburn, Alabama. Brad, you're on. What do you think?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hey, I just wanted to say that I think that this will be a long, slow process, and probably municipalities don't need to worry too much about the tax issue, because I really believe that most Americans appreciate the convenience and consistency that we get when I travel with my family. You know, I know if I stop at a chain motel, I'm going to pay more, but I know that the quality is going to be there. They're going to take care of my needs if there's an issue. I don't know, who's responsible for that kind of thing.
And right.
It's just consistent. I'll listen online.
Brad, I appreciate your call. I mean, along those lines, Jim in Spencer, Iowa says, he has an expression in his neck of the woods, they have works like a rented mule, i.e. not well. Well, Cindy in Newton, Massachusetts. Cindy, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Along the lines of what was just mentioned. We rented two condos in Florida, and they were wonderful. Mm-hmm. Then we rented one in San Francisco, and it was horrible. One bedroom, all the furniture consisted of a mattress on the floor.
Oh, welcome to your new luxurious abode.
Yeah, and the kitchen was not well equipped. It didn't have a coffee maker, you know, just basic things that most people want.
Was that Airbnb or something else?
It was Airbnb. The first two we did were VRBO, but this one was Airbnb.
Did you check their reputation before you rented it, Cindy, online?
My boyfriend took care of it all, and
uh-oh,
he was satisfied with it.
Okay,
there were no empty drawers, and the drawer on the nightstand was loaded with personal items that we really didn't want to know about.
Okay, there's community, maybe more community than you want right there.
Yeah.
On the other hand, people like sometimes the community aspect, but they want more than a mattress on the floor. Arun, over time, where do you see this so-called sharing economy going? How much of the big economy do you think it's going to envelop?
Well, I think both the traditional economy, what we think of as the traditional economy, and the sharing economy will coexist. There are certainly going to be people who like the comfort and the reliability and the predictability of a standard motel, or there are some people who will want to always stay at the Four Seasons or some sort of top-line luxury hotel who aren't going to be Airbnb customers or VRBO customers. But I think what we're seeing happen is that you know, because of the progress in digital technologies that lets us actually engage in this kind of sharing, you know, if you think about this historically, this kind of technological progress always grows the economy. It doesn't sort of take one behavior and substitute it for another. It creates a whole new way of consuming. And so I don't expect that a whole host of traditional economy businesses are going to go out of business, or that we're like, you know, we're going to see the death of hotels and traditional rental cars. There are sort of mainstream customers for whom these are still going to be appealing. I just think that these new marketplaces are going to sort of dramatically expand the set of choices that we have. You know, if I wanted to this afternoon rent a Porsche for an hour and just sort of drive it around the city because it's a nice day, I'm going to have the option to do that. That's not something I had the option to do. It's not taking away from something that Hertz or Avis, you know, could have offered me. On the other hand, if I, you know, go on business travel to, you know, an unfamiliar city, I might choose the traditional hotel because, you know, I want my breakfast at 6:30 and I want the reliable wake-up call.
I mean, maybe you're right that it doesn't bite into those old businesses, though we've seen a lot of old businesses take big bites since the internet came on stream. Lauren, we just got half a minute here. This has all kind of blown up, exploded during recessionary times. Is it possible that if the economy comes roaring back, people will say, oh, why would I want to use somebody else's? I'll buy my own drill.
To be honest, we think it's a bigger shift that's going on here, and it's actually been coming from another source of need to actually change the way we consume and actually collaborate together, because we're actually heading into a phase of resource limitations where we're actually going to need to think differently about how we access things and what we're buying and consuming. So what we hope to see is that the principles of this sharing economy actually expand into traditional business and they rethink the way they're actually going about their daily business as well.
And just a few seconds, public revenues, ultimately, there's a lot of things that are taxed now that, you know, pay for roads and all the rest. What about in this world?
Yeah, I think we're going to start to see a shift towards that more accountability from these new platforms as they start to take a bigger chunk of the pie. But we're also seeing economic investment pouring in from other sources, like visiting the local coffee shops in the area where I'm staying in my Airbnb, whereas typically I'd be only downtown in the tourist area. So there's a bigger change happening there as well.
Big, big shift underway, bigger than you might have known, and it's already out there. Lauren Anderson is with Collaborative Lab. She joined us today from San Francisco, California. Lauren, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And Arun Sundarajan is at the Stern School of Business at NYU. Arun, wonderful to have you with us. Thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
In a moment, bicycle sharing takes off in cities around the country. This is On Point. New York City introduced its bike-sharing program at the end of May, and Chicago quickly followed on in June. Columbus, Ohio launches bike-sharing this month. Boston, Washington, Chattanooga already there, with Omaha, Denver, Miami, Madison, Des Moines. Micheline Maynard has been covering the flurry of launches for Forbes magazine and joins us now from Ann Arbor, Michigan. Micheline Maynard, in Ann Arbor, are you there?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, great to have you. I understand Ann Arbor is lined up to do this as well. When?
Yes, the Ann Arbor system is in progress, and we should be seeing the bikes, I think, by fall here.
It's funny, for years, you and I talked about Detroit, which you covered, and the automobile industry, and now here we've got this evolutionary path into bicycles. What's pushing this, Mickey?
Well, a couple of things are pushing it. I mean, first of all, we got through the recession, and a lot of people lost some of their wealth, and everybody is rethinking the ways that they get around. That might just be driving less, but it also is showing up in ride sharing. It's showing up in people walking to work, taking public transit, and now most visibly in bike sharing programs.
And everybody seems to be doing it. I got a little picture here in the Daily Beast of the Great Gatsby, star Leonardo DiCaprio using the New York City's City Bike Share program, cycling around Soho. Do all these programs work in the same way? What's the standard formula, Mickey?
Standard formula is you have two choices. You can buy an annual membership, which ranges between $75 and about $100. And for that, you get to ride for about a half an hour for free and just jump on a bike and jump off of a bike. You get a little plastic key. And if you decide that you don't want to join, but you want to rent by the hour, rent for the day, then you put in your credit card and you buy a day pass or a week pass, that kind of thing. Then you find a bike stand that has the bikes, and you use your key to unlock a bike. There's some computer technology that tracks the bike and keeps tabs on how long you've got the bike, because that's how much you're going to be charged for using the bike. And then if you see another one of these bike stands, they're called docks in the bike sharing world.
Okay.
You just drop off the bike and click it into place.
And these docks many times tend to have a whole lot of bicycles, sort of standard design and distinctive paint job and branding on them.
Exactly. These are not like the kind of bikes that you race in the Tour de France. These are pretty clunky city bikes. Some of them have three gears, and they're painted with the name of the bike sharing. So you're very visible, and people are reporting in Chicago, for instance, they just started bike sharing last week. The bikes there are called Divvy, for divide and share.
Okay.
And people say that folks are waving at them as they ride by on their Divvy bike.
What do cities tend to charge per hour if that's the way you're doing it?
Well, essentially, the per hour charge is more baked into the daily rate.
Or daily rate, then.
Yeah, so you're paying a daily rate of, you know, $10, $15. Really, if you're going to do this seriously, the yearly membership makes the most sense, because you pay $75, you get a half an hour for free, then you pay above that. And then very shortly, if you're using a bike every single day, you're going to cover that $75 pretty quickly.
Is it working everywhere, or have some cities found bike docks full of unused bicycles once they started it?
Well, that has been an issue in some cities, because some of the bikes break down. Some of the docking equipment has broken down. Some cities like Chattanooga, which actually has the same kind of bike system that these other big cities do, found at the beginning that, you know, it wasn't being used as much as they had thought. And in some places, the bike racks aren't in the right places. And that's been one of the issues for Chicago, where people are saying, hey, you've put all these bike racks mostly downtown and in some of the northern neighborhoods, but I don't live there. How can I get a bike? That sort of thing. But obviously, this isn't something that's in its infancy in the United States. I think the oldest system is maybe 3 or 4 years old. So all these bugs will be worked out as people figure out where bike sharing demand actually is.
And are these programs, do they tend to be city-owned, or are they just contracted out? Who actually runs them?
It is a mix of that. The Chicago system is owned by the City of Chicago, CDOT, as they call it. In New York City, the city was behind the program, but they branded it, and Citibank actually bought the branding rights for City Bike.
Okay.
The best-run system seemed to have some kind of city involvement, because even though, you know, you might say, wow, this is a lot of money to ride a bike for an hour or so, they're not huge money makers. So nonprofit organizations and city organizations run bike sharing tend to be more successful than those that try to do it and actually make a living at it.
And are they year-round, Mickey? Chicago's pretty cold and snowy in the winter, or is it seasonal?
That's right. I mean, Montreal has bike sharing, and the bikes do go away in the winter. I think that you have to do that for a couple of reasons. First of all, you know, a lot of people are not used to riding in ice and snow. Second of all, roads are just not there to handle the bikes in the wintertime. So it'll tend to be a seasonal thing. However, in a place like New York and some of the southern cities, there isn't really any reason to put the bikes away because you're not going to have weather normally that's as bad as you get in the Northeast.
What's your guess? Is this coming, you know, to almost every city, Mickey, do you think, or just some?
I would say that cities that want to be global cities will probably have bike sharing. We've seen it abroad. We've seen it in Shanghai, London, Paris, and now American cities, I think, are going to be jumping on the bicycle bandwagon.
Micheline Maynard in Ann Arbor, Michigan today writes for Forbes and has been looking at all the bike sharing that's going on. Mickey, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my pleasure, Tom. Nice to speak with you.
You too. Listeners, it's great to have you here. Tomorrow for the 4th of July, we'll talk about American Revolution with historian Kevin Phillips looking at the Revolutionary Road before 1776. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.